ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It is Wednesday, the 6th of March. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, Super Tuesday in the United States. What's the outlook for the 2024 presidential campaign? And from the South Australian outback to Sweden, Australia's Eurovision contestants taking Indigenous lyrics to the world stage.
It was absolutely thrilling. We had our little fangirl moment and then everything, reality sunk in and we were like, oh my God, now we've got to work. Just to like deliver now when we get to Sweden.
First today to the economy, and the latest GDP figures out today show the economy continued to expand in the December quarter, but only just. Once again, China is vital to Australia's economy, propping up growth with its seemingly insatiable demand for Australian commodities. I'm joined now by the ABC senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, this GDP update, it is pretty soft. What are the chances of Australia heading into a recession?
Well, Sally, there had been earlier fears that there might have been a negative reading for the final quarter of this year, but that's been dispelled thanks in large part to China. But yeah, not a recession yet, and that's because we still have economic growth, but it is close to flatlining. In the final 3 months of 2023, according to the Bureau of Statistics, growth of just 0.2% seasonally adjusted. Forecasts had been for 0.3% and a very sluggish 1.4% growth over the 12 months. And to be clear, you need two quarters of negative growth or a contraction for a technical recession, and we haven't had one yet. But in the glass half full sense, it's the ninth straight rise in quarterly GDP, but growth is slowing, and you just need to look at GDP per capita or household that's gone backwards by a full percentage point in the quarter. This makes four consecutive quarters of a per capita contraction as household budgets are cut to deal with those 13 interest rate rises since May 2022 and the higher cost of living, especially with higher mortgage repayments, higher rent payments. So if it's not an official recession for many households, if it feels like one, it probably is one.
And Peter, China has been incredibly important with their demand for our commodities, but how long can that last?
Well, Sally, as long as China continues to grow, because China's very ambitious growth target was updated yesterday. That remains at 5% as Beijing seeks to keep the stellar growth going in the face of bankrupt property developers and indebted investors. And this means probably more demand for Australian iron ore and coal to keep China's construction machine going. And we saw this in Australia's current account surplus out yesterday. This adds an important boost to GDP. So once again, commodities look like saving the economy from going backwards. But also public spending provided a one-off boost through the Indigenous Voice to Parliament referendum from all those polling officials temporarily employed as part of the voting process.
So, Peter, given the slowing economy, what are the chances of interest rates being cut to avoid a recession?
Well, Sally, this strong demand from China and inflation still well above the Reserve Bank's 2 to 3% target band means the RBA will almost certainly leave the cash rate on hold when the board meets the week after next. There's been a lot of talk about rate cuts by the end of the year, maybe even in the coming months, but some of those bets are being scaled back and expectations are being managed. There will, of course, be a very close watch on monthly inflation and the next quarterly inflation reading in April to see if inflation does continue to fall. The RBA will be wanting to see real evidence that inflation is falling, confident that the economy can be slowed without triggering a recession. And for now, the chance of a hard economic landing does look unlikely.
Peter Ryan, thank you. Well, beyond the latest figures, economists say we are already experiencing the biggest dive in living standards in half a century. And as we've heard, although we may not be in an official recession, it sure does feel like one for many households and businesses. Alison Schau reports.
At Sydney's bustling Central Station, Dustin Wong has been selling flowers for 2 years.
We experienced the significant decline in sale. It's been very slow.
As his customers cut back on spending, his sales have declined about 35%.
Flour is a luxury, so they cause us to spend their money for that because it's not necessary if they don't have to.
Today's GDP figures show household spending rose by 0.1% at the end of last year, but is continuing to slow in the face of rising interest rates and high inflation. But Dustin Vuong says he's stressed about the situation and feeling the impact that cost of living pressures are having on his customers' spending.
I feel unsettled because every day is you have to play by ear, and it's not a good feeling of the unknown, like every day.
The same pressures are being reflected in many households. Single mum Zainab Akil is raising four kids and relies on Centrelink payments and help from charities in order to make ends meet.
I'm not able to pay any bills anymore. Everything is coming up, the prices. You go to supermarket, you spend $300, $400, you come back home, like barely enough for two or three days.
She's had to cut back on non-essential spending.
We used to every 3-4 weeks, I can take the kids out. Now, nothing. I used to take them to cinema every few months. Now, I can't. My oldest one, he's 20. He has long hair. I say, if I want to take my boys to regularly haircut, it's really, really I don't know how people can afford to do that.
Households are feeling like they're in a recession because their living standards are going backwards.
Greg Jericho is the chief economist at the Australia Institute.
What we know is that households are really starting to cut back on non-essential items. A lot more of their income is having to be devoted to paying off the essential items, the bills that you can't avoid paying. And things like the fact that businesses are really running down their inventories. It's in a sense they don't have much confidence that there's going to be a lot of sales to come.
He says today's GDP figures reflect how precarious the country's economy is right now.
We know that households are really struggling. We know household real disposable income is going backwards. We know that unemployment is rising. So yes, GDP might be not technically in a recession, but you need to think about the reality that a lot of any sort of good aspects are coming from mining exports. They are not having much of an impact at all on households. That's all just essentially going into corporate profits.
Mr. Jericho says the figures show while Australia might not technically be in a recession, when it comes to the standard of living, the nation is going backwards.
On a per capita basis, the economy is extremely weak. And certainly, we're not talking a deep recession, but we're certainly not talking a strong economy and certainly one where the Reserve Bank should not at all be thinking about needing to raise interest rates any further.
The Reserve Bank makes its next interest rate decision on March 19.
That's Alison Schell. You're listening to The World Today. Overseas now, and millions of voters in the US have cast their ballots in Super Tuesday contests. It's usually a turning point in the campaign for the Democratic and Republican presidential nominations. Joe Biden and Donald Trump are already expected to represent their respective parties in the November presidential election. But some of the traditional battle lines have been blurred. EJ Dion is a columnist with the Washington Post, senior fellow with the Brookings Institution, and a professor at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C.
A big chunk of the working class has moved to the right and far right in the case of Trump. And right now, Donald Trump Republicans do better, much better among the working class than the Democrats do. That's a huge change in our politics when you look historically. What offsets that for the Democrats is that Donald Trump once said, "I love the poorly educated." And what he was talking about is the problem he has with college educated voters. And so you have a kind of inversion of the class pattern. Now, Joe Biden is an old working class Democrat. His economic program has actually done a lot for, you know, smaller places around the country, but that hasn't yet created a big surge back to the Democrats.
And I was interested to see as well in your analysis that Donald Trump is polling a lot better with Black and Latino voters, better than he did in 2016 and 2020. What do you think is going on there, EJ?
Well, I think doing particularly well among Latino voters. And I think some of that is just the diversity within the Latino community. We use that term a lot here. But you're talking about people from all over Latin America, and that some Latino groups are much more inclined to the Republicans, partly because of what they're reacting to in the countries they came from, particularly the Cubans. I think what's also happening is that parts of the Latino community, for example, who work in the oil industry, Biden and the Democrats have embraced action against climate change. Latinos who work in the oil industry look at that and worry about their employment. And some Latinos who have been here a long time worry about immigration the way, you know, longtime voters from other places do. So that's part of it. With Black voters, it's been much more contained. He hasn't made huge gains, but there's some evidence that he's made some gains among, you know, Black men more than Black women. And there may be something about the way Trump approaches the world. And there are some positive memories of the Trump economy. And so all of that is playing into that.
From a distance, I think there's a curiosity, EJ, as to how this second time around we may end up with the same two contenders as last time from a nation of, what, 340-odd million people. How does that happen?
It doesn't happen very often. In fact, the last time that a president who lost an election immediately ran again, and he won, was Grover Cleveland. He was elected in 1884, lost in 1888, and then got elected in 1892. That's a long time ago. So you're quite right that this is a very unusual circumstance. There are a lot of people around Biden who have said that if Trump had been dispatched, if he were out of politics, Biden might not have run. And so I think the fact that Trump has survived increase the chances that Joe Biden would run again. And with Trump as the opponent, a lot of Democrats decided they did not want to divide the party. And on the Republican side, I think Trump's hold on the Republican Party is just a remarkable thing. And he strengthened his hold despite 91 indictments, despite January 6th. Some of that is that the anti-Trump Republicans, a lot of them have left the party. They're not voting in these primaries anymore. But there is a degree of, I'll use the word fanatical, devotion to Trump that's not like anything we've seen very often in our politics.
That's EJ Dion, columnist with the Washington Post and senior fellow with the Brookings Institution. Well, let's have a look at music now. And a language spoken by Indigenous communities in far north South Australia will be beamed into hundreds of millions of homes around the globe when Australian pop duo Electric Fields takes to the Eurovision stage in May. The South Australian band has been chosen to represent the nation at this year's song contest in Sweden. Eurovision prides itself as a non-political event, but with the war in Ukraine and Israel's continued bombardment of Gaza, politics will be hard to ignore. Angus Randall reports.
A dance anthem about a united world, Electric Fields will be representing the nation at Eurovision in May.
It was absolutely thrilling. We had our little fangirl moment and then everything, reality sunk in and we were like, oh my God, now we've got to work.
Singer Zachariah Fielding says the song One Milkily, One Blood has lyrics in the Yunkanjara language to honour his connection to his people in South Australia's far north. It's the first time an Australian First Nations language will feature at the event.
So I'm from Mimili community from the APY lands, and the word Milkily is a Yunkanjara word. I'm a Yunkanjara speaker.
Despite some obvious geographical barriers, Australia has been competing in Eurovision since 2015. Ashley Dudecourt is the drummer for Perth band Voyager, which was last year's entrant. Promise me it's
gonna be all right. What I found really fun about the whole thing was just like saying yes to everything and just enjoying, you know, every part of it, because you do get asked to do like about a million and one things. There's so much press, there's so many events you can go to, and it's all really fun. So, like, as much as your energy reserves will allow, you should just do as much as you can because you only get one shot at it.
Alison Lewis is Professor Emeritus at the University of Melbourne. She's taught courses on Eurovision. She says electric fields are a much stronger contestant now than when they just missed out on being Australia's entrant in 2019.
I think they've really had a lot more experience since then, and they're more experienced at live performances, so I think they should do well. It's really hard to say. With Australia these days, we haven't been doing all that well. So it's not clear whether, you know, what we think is good translates in to a European stage. But I think they should do well, maybe the top 10.
Along with the fierce artistic competition, political tensions often find a way of rising to the surface, despite rules aimed at keeping politics out.
There should be no explicit political messaging or statements, and they don't tolerate any non-national flags. So that's the clause, but the interpretation of that can vary quite considerably from year to year. And sometimes they invoke it and sometimes they don't.
Ukraine won 2 years ago as voters showed support in the early stages of the Russian invasion. But President Volodymyr Zelensky was banned from making a speech at the event last year. This year, the contest has to deal with the fallout of the Israel-Gaza war. Organisers have already asked Israel to change lyrics to its likely song entry that was seen to reference the October 7th Hamas attacks. Professor Alison Lewis says it'll be tough to keep politics at bay.
Things are so incredibly polarised at the moment over the Israel and the Gaza war, and I think it's going to be a little bit too much for them to handle this year. With Russia's invasion of Ukraine, things were not polarised. It was very, very clear cut, and Russia just withdrew. But Israel is very, very keen to attend and not to be kicked out of the contest, and so I think they will negotiate, but then it's going to be really tricky for the producers in Sweden to limit the protests. Yeah, I don't think it's going to be pretty, actually. I think it's going to be really tricky.
The contest takes place in Sweden in early May.
That's Angus Randall. There are renewed safety warnings in the wake of the first deaths in New South Wales from a lithium-ion battery fire. Two people were killed in the blaze inside a home at Lake Macquarie last Thursday, while two others managed to escape. Fire authorities and experts say there are basic steps that people can take to reduce the risks associated with the batteries. Elizabeth Cramsey reports.
The dangers of lithium-ion batteries are becoming more and more apparent.
There's a dramatic rise in the number of lithium-ion battery fires. If we just look back to 2022, there was 165 lithium-ion battery-related fires. In 2023, we recorded 256. So far this year, in 2024, we've had 45.
That's Fire and Rescue New South Wales Acting Assistant Commissioner Terry Farley. He says this year in New South Wales, there's been an average of 5 fires every week associated with lithium-ion batteries. In Turralba last week, 90 minutes north of Sydney, two people were killed in a house fire, which investigators say was caused by a lithium-ion battery overheating and exploding in flames.
Lithium-ion batteries tend to go into what we call a thermal runaway. That's the process where the battery is damaged or is compromised, it's overheated. It then causes a chemical reaction, which then the battery lets off a toxic gas and then bursts into flame. That flame's quite violent and explosive, and that's why it can cause a lot of damage in regards to fire.
Acting Assistant Commissioner Farley says fire authorities are trying to educate people who use lithium-ion battery devices like e-bikes and e-scooters on how to manage them more safely.
Never leave it on charge unattended. If you're charging it, obviously don't have any flammable materials or combustible materials around that. If it's getting hot, obviously remove the battery and remove it from the power source and put it safely, so in a cool, dry area. Obviously make sure you have a working smoke alarm in your house, and most importantly, have a fire evacuation plan.
Experts say people should try to charge e-scooters and e-bikes outside and to thoroughly check devices and cables. Dr. Adam Best is the principal research scientist at CSIRO. he's encouraging consumers to purchase better quality products, which are less likely to catch fire compared to more cheaply made devices.
You get what you pay for. So we are seeing anecdotally, when I emphasise anecdotally, that people that buy the cheaper battery packs for e-scooters and e-bikes and the like are generally going to see probably products that are not made so well.
Some experts believe more regulatory intervention is needed. A report from the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission last year called for stronger and more appropriate regulation on lithium-ion batteries, including a national framework for electrical safety regulation. Dr. Mohammed Azhar is an engineering lecturer at Edith Cowan University. He supports the ACCC's recommendations.
Yes, I think that that is needed. It's like a collective responsibility. So from the technology developers, the regulators, and definitely the end users. So it's all combination.
He says work is being done to make these batteries safer and to find alternatives.
That will be the responsibility, as I said, of definitely the people of science and technology and also the policymaker, the government, to invest more, do more research, develop better, safer lithium-ion battery technology.
In the meantime, Dr. Azhar says more education is needed for consumers to understand the risks and how to charge these devices safely.
It's Elizabeth Cramsey and Catherine Gregory with that report. Public pools play a vital role in many towns across Australia as a place to catch up, to cool off, and to learn a vital skill, swimming. But hundreds of public pools face an uncertain future. The Royal Life Saving Society of Australia estimates around 500 pools nationally are at least 50 years old, meaning they require costly repairs. Local councils, which run most public pools, say they need more funding support. One community has taken the challenge into its own hands. Nikita Jager reports.
For many Australians, taking a trip to the local pool is a nostalgic tradition and an easy way to cool off in the summer heat. For Holly White Butler, the Wingham Memorial Pool on the New South Wales mid-north coast holds many happy memories.
That was our whole childhood. There was a whole group of us. We were always here, you know, learning to swim, swimming training, swimming club, carnivals. It was our life growing up.
But the facility is now 56 years old and it needs major repairs. RJ Houston from the Royal Life Saving Society says there are hundreds of others around the country just like it.
Many pools across Australia were built in the 50s, 60s and 70s, and really they're only designed to last about 50 years. So some of the concrete shell in the pool tank, some of the pipework that's underground, some of the infrastructure that supports the pool circulation system, all of that infrastructure is now approaching the end of that lifespan and needs to be replaced.
The State of Aquatic Facility Infrastructure in Australia report commissioned by the RLSA in 2022 estimates an extra $3 billion will be needed for pool replacements in the next 10 to 15 years. In Wingham, the total replacement bill could be up to $5 million, according to the Mid-Coast Council, which operates the facility. It's a high price that has some residents worried about the pool's future.
Come on in. This is the main pool here.
Now, locals like Ron Spriggs are taking the matter into their own hands and have started a fundraising group called Friends of Wingham Pool.
It's showing its age. It was built back in the 1960s, like a lot of other pools, and needs some pretty urgent repairs. Council had a report done which suggested that the pool stay open under a different system.
The group also hopes to start running the pool themselves. Replacing ageing pools is one challenge, but President of Local Government New South Wales, Daria Turley, says another major pressure is the cost of maintenance.
We did a report last year and found that councils are facing a $5.4 billion backlog in infrastructure, and that includes swimming pools.
The Royal Life Saving Society's RJ Houston says a national pool infrastructure strategy could help ensure the survival of public pools.
Much more investment is needed at all three levels of government into maintaining swimming pool infrastructure. And we also need an aquatic strategy, an infrastructure strategy at a national level to ensure that we've got, you know, equitable access to pools and that they're available in every community that need them.
More than 330 million people are estimated to visit a public pool every year in Australia, according to Royal Life Saving. For Wingham local Gary Ferris, it's an important meeting place and a safe spot for kids to swim.
It means everything to me because it's a great place for kids. There's a nice area over here. And when it's low tide, it's not much fun swimming in the river. And there's sharks out there occasionally.
Wingham resident Holly White Butler is determined to ensure as many people as possible can continue this tradition.
I grew up learning to swim here. Ron actually taught me to swim here all those years ago. And my grandparents were pretty instrumental in organising a lot of the fundraising to have the pool built. Pretty important to us. We're going to do as much as we can to keep it going.
It's a Wingham resident, Holly White Butler, there, ending that report from Nikita Jager. That's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara. Take care.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. For more than 20 years, Australians have turned to Botox when unwanted wrinkles begin to emerge. So why have regulators decided to crack down on it now? Today we speak to a long-time Botox user and a health law expert about why we need to rethink what we're injecting. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.